United States v. Adcock. Mr. Meyer.
May it please the Court. I'm John Meyer. With me at council table is Bree Wilde from Fulan Lardner. Also in the courtroom today are members of Thomas Adcock's family, his wife, the children, and some of his brothers and sisters. This case concerns a small contract to paint apartments operated by the Housing Authority of Christian County. Tom Adcock was the maintenance supervisor, and while in that role, he submitted bids for and ultimately won the bid to paint those apartments. In our allotted time today, I will begin by addressing the district court's incorrect definition of and calculation of loss. And then, if there is enough time, I'll move on to the other issues addressed in our briefs, namely the failure to prove wire fraud and the failure to prove intent to defraud. Government's primary complaint in this case is not that it suffered a loss, but that Thomas Adcock profited from the painting contract.
I'm not sure that's quite the government's theory, because it seems to me they're arguing that the evidence shows that Ms. Miller, who did the painting, got $29,000 or so for the work. And given the way Mr. Adcock was approaching things, in a sense, we never found out whether that's what the contract would have been. But the court finds that that was, in fact, the amount that got paid, and all the rest of it was unlawful gain to Mr. Adcock.
I don't believe the court made a determination of what the fair market value was of the contract.
Why does that have to be done when we know what money was paid for the services?
When determining loss, the government's loss, under the sentencing guidelines and under the leading cases, the court must look at the difference between the price of the contract and the fair market value of the loss, or fair market value of the services rendered.
Well, but why isn't the fair market value the price it actually got paid for it, which is the 29? I mean, the contract is some evidence of that, but we have better evidence, which is what the woman took.
Well, there are two separate evidentiary issues that I think counter that point. One is that there was a competitive bid where eight private contractors each submitted bids. The lowest, and it's uncontested in this case, that the lowest and best bid was that of A-Plus Maintenance, which was Mr. Adcock's company. The second point is that after A-Plus Maintenance ceased painting the apartments, the Housing Authority went back and reissued the contract to Nadine Miller, who presumably would be willing to accept less at the exact same price it was originally contracted at. That's almost definitive proof that the fair market value here was what was charged out by A-Plus Maintenance.
Mr. Adcock get the profit from this? I mean, you know, it's a strange argument you're making, really, when the finding of fact is that he didn't do anything for the rest of that money. I know you have an alternative view of that, but the court doesn't agree with you.
Well, you're right. I do have an alternative view. I do believe that there is evidence that Mr. Adcock did a number of things to support the contract, from initiating the bid through administering the contract, managing payroll, paying for supplies, according to Nadine Miller herself, and going through and basically doing all the administrative function for this contract.
Before you get much further with this, though, the government argues that you've waived your argument on loss anyway, that the exchange between Mr. Adcock's trial counsel and the court was actually very clear that the loss amount was accepted and these various other issues went only to how much restitution needed to be paid.
I think that this situation is very similar to the situation the court faced in the James case, in that here waiver requires an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right. And under these circumstances, I don't think it can be said that Mr. Adcock relinquished his right knowingly to receive a lower sentence.
Why not? Because, I mean, there's a very clear question. The court tries to clarify it a couple of times to make sure that she understands what these arguments are going to. And the lawyer who is entitled to speak for Mr. Adcock says, oh, this is only for restitution. She reiterates, and yes, this is only for restitution.
Well, I believe the court should review this in terms of the circumstances of the case. And here at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Adcock was asked very early on in the hearing whether he acknowledged that he understood the objections being made, and he acknowledged that he did. Later on in the hearing, much later in the hearing, there was a discussion about the specifics of what was being waived and what wasn't. And that was far removed, I think, from Mr. Adcock's acknowledgement of the objections. Furthermore, in any event, there's no strategic or tactical reason for his attorney to have waived this objection.
Well, but maybe there is, in that the rules for determining loss are, in fact, different from the rules for determining restitution.
And yet, Your Honor, the formula is basically the same. The equation is the same. The court, unless this is a circumstance where there's a government benefit, and we argue that there's not a government benefit here in the contract itself, the equation is simple. It's the difference between the contract value, the price, and the fair market value of the goods received. There's no evidence here that the government received anything but what it bargained for, which was the fair market value of painting in this.
So in your theory, if somebody submitted an inflated bid to rebuild the Dan Ryan Expressway in Chicago, and the government accepted that bid, and then the Dan Ryan Expressway was rebuilt, but it turned out that a lot of that money was simply lining the pockets of the contractor illegally, maybe it's somebody with a conflict of interest who shouldn't have bid or whatever, there's no offense there?
Well, the offense is obviously acquiring the contract without being in a position where he could. And the
so any amount of money, though, as long as the government's foolish enough to buy it, any amount of money, even though people aren't being honest with the government when they submit the bid, is automatically value to the government, in your view?
No, Your Honor. I think that the court addressed this in the Frost case, specifically with a hypothetical similar to the one that you're bringing up. And there the court said that if a contractor received a highway contract to build a highway, and they did it by fraudulent means, the loss for purposes of calculating sentencing would be the difference between the price that they charged and what the actual value of the actual highway built was. Here we have evidence throughout that's uncontested that the value of what was delivered was consistent with what the price of the contract was.
In what sense uncontested?
It's not contested that the apartments were in need of painting, that this was submitted as a competitive bid, that there were eight private companies that bid, and that of the eight, the lowest and best bidder in a timely fashion was awarded the contract. There's no evidence that any of the residents of the HACC homes claimed that there was anything wrong with the work that was done at the apartments. There is evidence that some other individuals there did, but there's no evidence that anyone who actually benefited directly from these from the painting suffered any loss.
And was this an open bid just for whoever? It wasn't any set aside or any targeted contractors. This is open to anyone who wanted to come in and bid?
That's correct, and that's an important distinction because in the government's brief, they make a point that that Mr. Adcock was an unintended beneficiary. That distinction is important when there's a grant or entitlement program or some kind of loan, whether it's a Pell grant or whether this was if this had been an SBA set aside, for example, it would be a different situation. If Mr. Adcock hypothetically had gone into an SBA set aside arrangement and misrepresented the fact that he was a woman or a minority or an underrepresented person from a geographical region, then yes, the calculation would be different. But here, this was a straight open bid for a painting contract. And in this open bidding process, the best and lowest bid won. That, I think, represents strong, if not definitive, evidence that that was the fair market value of the contract here.
Why, when the government isn't given accurate information about that bid? Doesn't fair market value imply that there has been reliable information conveyed on both sides?
I think the government's problem here, again, is that Mr. Adcock profited from this, and given his position at the authority, he should not have. That's a separate issue from what the enhancement to his sentence should be under the sentencing guidelines, which make clear the fair market value is what, in an open market, the government would pay. Here, the government paid based on a competitive bidding process. They did not have information about Mr. Adcock's involvement, but they did have plenty of information about what the market would bear and what they would be able to get for their bargain on the market. Furthermore, in the next step, after this had all been Mr. Adcock's involvement had been determined, and after A-plus maintenance ceased painting, they came back and again awarded the contract to Nadine Miller, who presumably, and this is, I think, an error the trial court made, presumably would have taken this job at the $29,000 level, which she was paid. And they paid her the exact same amount that A-plus maintenance was paid originally. That's what the market value of this painting contract was.
Did Mr. Adcock obtain any advantage by being an insider so that he was able to underbid everyone else.
That's not clear from the record, and there's no evidence in the record that that was the case.
So the government re-awarded the contract retrospectively? Is that what you're telling us?
After A-plus maintenance ceased painting, they awarded the contract, and I believe it was as an independent contractor to Nadine Miller. And rather than go back and pay what she was willing to accept, which is what the court and what the assistant U.S. attorney and the probation officer presumed, they didn't do that. In fact, they went back and paid her exactly per apartment what was charged out in the original agreement.
So that happened after sentencing then? So that is or is not a part of the record?
That was not after sentencing. That is a part of the record. Oh. In effect, I'm sorry.
So the government paid twice?
The government, this was an ongoing contract. The government didn't pay twice, but there were, you know, as apartments needed to be painted on an ongoing basis, this contract was extended. So originally it was A-plus maintenance. When it became apparent that Mr. Adcock was involved and A-plus maintenance needed to be removed from this contract, they still needed apartments to be painted. There was still a need for this to get done for various reasons, both to maintain it and also to maintain their HUD funding. And so they went to Nadine Miller, who, while the government claims was not doing a sufficient job, obviously was doing a good enough job that she would be rehired by the authority. They went back to Nadine Miller and paid her the exact same amount that was originally bid.
Was it rebid?
It was not rebid.
So it was just continued?
Just continued.
And I assume they paid with the completion of the painting of each apartment?
Correct, which is the exact same way that they did originally.
So there wasn't money paid with, at least under that old contract, that was not the first apartment was painted. They paid the completion. I think they were talking about the difference that he got versus what she got, but apparently she got paid, what, $190 or something?
She got paid significantly less in the original deal.
But they did it with the completion of each apartment painted.
That's right.
Was it your intention, I was a little unclear from your brief, to reassert your guidelines loss calculation arguments on the restitution issue?
That's right. We believe that the same argument applies as to restitution, and that there was an error below, and it's an abuse of discretion standard, but an error below in not considering the proper factors when determining what restitution should be. The court, the U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney, the probation officer who put together the pre-sentencing report, and Mr. Adcock's own counsel all got it wrong. They got it wrong as to the loss calculation for sentencing and as to loss calculation for restitution.
Right, but in your brief, the argument that was asserted on the matter of restitution had to do with an unpainted apartment or something.
That was referring to the only reference in the pre-sentencing report to work that was not completed was one unpainted apartment in the pre-sentencing that it was referred to by the probation officer. There are arguments by the government in their briefing that there were other issues of value not being provided, the alleged overbillings and whatnot. These are all matters that should be remanded to the trial court for determination of what the true value of this contract was. I see that I've run into my rebuttal time. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'll reserve the remainder.
That's fine. Thank you very much. Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Patrick Hansen. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Central District of Illinois. I was the trial counsel for the case of the United States versus Thomas Adcock, and I believe I can address the question as to what happened after Mr. Adcock was discovered, if you will. Basically, he went before the Board of Commissioners, the evidence was, and the Board of Commissioners said, you can't do this. You can't have a part of this. Remove yourself from the contract. And that was the easiest thing to do at the time. This was March, April of 2001 or so. And so Nadine Miller continued painting apartments under the name of Grace Painting. That lasted approximately 2 months when the board got together and said, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to rebid this thing to see what the true value was. And Nadine Miller was removed from the contract, and the rebids were done. So to say that this was a measure of the fair market value really doesn't follow with the evidence in the case.
But I think Mr. Meyer's primary argument is that fair market value is normally thought of as what a willing buyer is willing to pay for a willing seller of services or goods, and that was the contract price. And so why should we enhance the sentence by losses sort of inside that price?
Presuming the issue wasn't waived, I can address it very simply. If fair market value was willing buyer, willing seller, we had a willing person to paint the apartments for less than half of what this contract price was. She did it for almost 2 years for less than half the price. She would have continued to do it for less than half the price, even if the contract was in her name. She didn't only because Tom Adcock was in control of all this stuff. All he did was remove his name and put her name on it, and they continued paying at the same price. Had they renegotiated at that time, had they taken a step back and said, Nadine Miller, you're doing this for less than half the price, will you continue to do so? I submit to the court that it's reasonable to conclude that she certainly would have. That if indeed that was the level of work that was acceptable, and the only reason it was acceptable, I submit to the court, is because Tom Adcock was supervising on behalf of the Housing Authority. If that was the level of work that they wanted, that's what they were getting. And she was willing to be paid whatever Tom Adcock was paying her. When he said, sign here, you're now the contractor, she signed there. She was now the contractor. This was a person, and we were surrounded, Mr. Adcock was surrounded with people that trusted him, that did what he said. He directed, he led, they followed. The reason this contract, this painting came up in the first place and ended up in a five-year grant proposal was because Mr. Adcock suggested it to Reva Woolard, who was then the executive director, who trusted him, who listened to what he said and followed his direction.
Now, let's get back to the waiver point. Mr. Knoll and the court have an exchange on this issue where the court says you're arguing it as to the restitution figure, not for the calculation of amount of loss for guideline purposes. Mr. Knoll says correct. Mr. Myers argued at least as applied here, there really isn't any difference between the computation of loss for the guidelines and the restitution formula.
I think there may be no real difference. Although with restitution, you're dealing with has money been paid back? We're talking completely different statutes. In this case, no money was paid back. Some apparently had been intended to pay back, but the checks were never cashed. So there has been no restitution made as far as that was concerned.
But if they really are the same, then why isn't an objection to restitution sufficient to preserve an objection to amount of loss?
Because the court has to make two different determinations. They're not always the same, and it's not always the same calculation because the court only has to make a reasonable estimate under the guidelines, and a lot of factors go into that, including the intended amount of loss, and oftentimes you can't get to a specific number of a loss, and oftentimes it does end up to be the same calculation or at least the same process in getting to the number.
And my question is, I recognize that it may not always be the same, but if we happen to be in a situation where it's the same, and what we are confronting is the question whether waiver has occurred, why shouldn't we say we can at least entertain the arguments that Mr. Adcock would like to raise on the amount of loss point?
I suppose we're talking form over substance then. What is the district court to do when a lawyer stands in front of her and says, we're not arguing this. This is not our point. And at some point during the process, specifically looked at Mr. Adcock and said, do you understand these objections, this commentary that your lawyer filed? And he said, yes.
Anything you would have said or introduced or done differently if you had thought amount of loss was actively being contested?
No. I believe the amount of loss was in the record. It was sufficient. And if I can point the court to the sentencing transcript, towards the end of it, it's in the defendant's brief, appendix 46 and 47, the court specifically says to Mr. Adcock, look, if Nadine Miller was willing to do this work for $29,000, if she'd only submitted a bid in her name, they wouldn't have paid $70,000. So the court is actually finding for restitution purposes the same calculation as she would for the loss. They got $29,000 worth of painting. the district court says. They got to say that they got felt full value says it's okay for you to pocket $38,000 for doing virtually nothing except pocketing the money through your bank accounts for A1. So I submit to the court that if we get past that waiver question, the court's already answered that question. There would be no additional evidence on either side. The fair market value argument was made at sentencing. It was made at the trial, in fact, and the jury rejected it. The district court rejected it and ordered the restitution in the same amount as the court found the loss. So if we get through those procedural hurdles, if we even get to that question, I submit to you that the court's already answered that question, and there would be no difference.
Who made the determination that the quality of the work was up to snuff? I'll talk about type of paint,
yeah.
Number of coats, the quality of the painting, all that.
There were four different individuals who worked as custodians or worked with the maintenance department who testified during the course of the trial. My recollection is at least two of them said they questioned the quality of the work. Closets wouldn't be painted. Appliances would not be moved, pictures not taken off the wall, things would be painted around, whereas a professional painter would have done a better job with that. At least one said when they complained to Mr. Adcock there was a little retaliation for it, and he learned to shut up.
Well, was Mr. Adcock the final determination? Did he make the final determination on quality during this time?
As far as the Housing Authority was concerned, this was Mr. Adcock's department, the maintenance department. Now, he denied that he was in charge of this, but where else would it go? He was in charge of the maintenance. He was in charge of the painting. He was in charge for the Housing Authority for giving directions to this painter. So he should have been, had he been performing his functions correctly, in charge of also the quality control of it as the maintenance director for the entire Housing Authority.
Well, was there any suggestion or even evidence or whatever that he overrode subordinates' complaints that they were not painting behind pictures and moving
There was a suggestion from at least one of the subordinates that after they brought it up once, they didn't dare bring it up again. So to that extent, yes, he overrode them. Nothing changed, certainly, in the quality of the painting, and they just went about their ways and minded their own business. So there is a...
It says with the closets, some of the tenants weren't giving permission to have the closets painted.
That is Mr. Adcock's position. That is what he testified to. The tenants did not testify. I do not know whether that is the case or not. All I know is some of the maintenance workers did register complaints, did say this is not the quality of work we should be having, and Mr. Adcock accepted it on behalf of the Housing Authority that was the quality of work they were going to get.
Now, there's a suggestion throughout this that HUD itself requires a certain level of maintenance. Are there regulations about how often things have to be painted or how they're painted, or this is more kind of a generalized appearance of unit kind of rule? Or
I believe that there are regulations or there are guidelines in HUD that they were not following prior to this time. Prior to 1999 and Mr. Adcock becoming the maintenance director, and that is why it became part of this five-year plan, why he suggested it as part of it, because there were some, they're getting dinged, I guess, on some of the HUD audits that came through. And what we're really talking about is apartments where people have lived for more than 5 years. So they hadn't been painted for 5 years and no move-outs, and these are occupied apartments, so they would be a little bit different than the empty apartments that they were painting as a matter of course. I submit to the court, Mr. Adcock, as far as the sufficiency of the evidence is concerned, did everything that he could to disguise his relationship to this contract.
Let me ask you about the use of the wires. I mean, Mr. Adcock, after all, is a maintenance person. I'm sure he gets paid as an employee, but why are we assuming that maintenance people know everything about how the government, through HUD, wires funds to the authority that he works for and all the rest of that?
We don't assume that, and I don't suggest that Mr. Adcock knew everything there would be to know about the ELOC system or the drawdown system or even that. What Mr. Adcock knew, and of which he was a part, was that this was a part of a comprehensive five-year grant or plan, something other than our day-to-day budget. And that's its five-year plan or grant came from HUD, somewhere other than the Christian County Housing Authority or the Housing Authority of Christian County. He knew that when he submitted invoices, even for other people, when other people were waiting for their money, there was a wait as this money was transferred.
Would you be arguing that use of the wires was reasonably foreseeable if it was just a direct deposit handled electronically from the Christian County Authority into A1's account?
If it was part of the original, if this was part of their operating funds?
Just really asking, do you think all electronic deposits involve use of the wires?
I think it is reasonably foreseeable, as I think the Fifth Circuit has held in the Mann case, that a transfer of money from a distance is reasonable for.
What if it's next door? What if it's Chase Bank on Dearborn transferring something to Bank of America on Clark Street, but they do it electronically? Isn't that use of the wires?
It is. And
so I don't know why distance has anything to do with it.
Excuse me?
I don't know why distance has anything to do with it. It's a methodology.
Right. And I think in this day and age, it is reasonably foreseeable that the money's going to come from somewhere via the use of the mail or the wires. So the only difference is we're talking about a different statutory nexus, the mail or the wire.
You charged, though, use of the wires. If you had meant to charge, if it turned out on the proof that for some reason they were using paper checks and putting them in envelopes and sending them to the mail, you would have used the wrong statute. You can't just say, oh, you know, let's change statutes.
Right. And if the evidence was that they had used the mail, we would have charged it as a mail fraud. The fraud is the same either way.
I understand the fraud is the same, but you need to charge the right thing, and you need to show that he did the thing you charged him with doing.
Precisely. And we believe it's reasonable that the evidence was sufficient to show that it was reasonably foreseeable that he would know the money's coming from somewhere. And had it come from the mail, I think we could say legitimately that it was reasonably foreseeable that it would have been transferred through the mail, just as it's reasonably foreseeable that it's transferred through a wire. That the knowledge specifically as to the conveyance, I don't think is going to make a difference. I don't think you need to know what's going to be an interstate wire rather than a wire. You know it's coming from HUD, be it paper or wire, and I think the evidence was sufficient to show that he knew enough about that system that the money was being transferred from HUD on a case-by-case basis as the invoices were being
submitted. And you're saying he also knew enough that it was reasonably foreseeable to him that it used the wires in particular.
Yes.
And that's where I'm not sure where your proof lies.
You mean as opposed to coming in the mail?
Yeah, right.
I think that he was knowledgeable enough with the system. He had been in that building for a sufficient period of time. He had been even beyond the time he was a supervisor. He was living just right down the street from the office. I think he was familiar enough with the grant system that the jury could reasonably see that it could come to the conclusion, a reasonable jury can come to the conclusion that this was a reasonable, foreseeable thing for him. Seeing that my time is almost up, again, I submit that Mr. Adcock defrauded everybody around him. He did so by subterfuge, misrepresentations, and this court should uphold the convictions. Thank you.
Okay. Anything further, Mr. Meyer?
Yes. Okay.
You have a minute or so. We'll.
I'd like to address a few points then. One, there's nothing in the record that Nadine Miller would have ever been involved in this contract but for Tom Adcock's involvement. And so when the government submits that she would have been willing to do this for $29,000 and he charged so much more, it's unreasonable to make that point because there's nothing to suggest that she would have ever, she didn't have the ability to do this, she didn't have the access to it, and she testified that she never would have done this but for Tom Adcock coming to her and asking her to work on the painting contract. Separately, I think here it's important to look again at James James. I think it's a very it's on point, particularly with regard to both the waiver and the forfeiture and effective assistance, and the fact that, as in James James, here everybody at the trial court level got this wrong. Everyone who is charged with knowing the law got the law wrong with regard to loss calculation. The probation officer, who was relied upon by the assistant U.S. attorney and the district court judge, and then ultimately Mr. Adcock's own counsel got it wrong, and Mr. Adcock is being asked to carry the burden of their error by serving additional time due to this enhancement that should have never been given. That's an unjust outcome that I ask this court to look at and consider remanding for resentencing. And then finally, as to Weyer, I think the evidence is clear that there is no evidence that he was ever processing invoices. He never approved payments. He didn't have access to the electronic system. The government did not submit any evidence that he was required as a supervisor to input anything electronically. In fact, the evidence shows that there was no electronic accounting system in place, no computer accounting system in place until after this contract had ended. So there was no basis for Mr. Adcock to know. Everything was handled in paper at this time. And I think the government makes a great leap, and no rational jury could find without reasonable doubt that he had knowingly or should have known that Weyer would be used here.
All right. Thank you very much. You were appointed, were you not?
I was.
And we appreciate very much your assistance to your client. We appreciate that of your firm. Very helpful to the court. And we thank the U.S. Attorney as well.